IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran calls on the Afghan people and political leaders to take tough decisions for their futures. Tehran hosts talks between a Taliban delegation and prominent Afghan figures. South Korea registers its second highest number of daily COVID-19 cases ever, just days after it began easing social distancing restrictions. And the death toll from the collapse of a building in Florida rises to 36 as rescue workers keep searching for more than 109 people who are still missing. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says the people and the leaders of Afghanistan must make difficult decisions for their future of the country. Zarif referred to the years-long failed presence of American troops in Afghanistan and its destructive consequences. He called on Afghanistan's leaders and political movements to return to the negotiating tables of the intra-Afghan peace talks and committing to political solutions. Iran's top diplomat also announced Tehran's readiness to assist the process of that dialogue solving the ongoing crises in Afghanistan and contributing to the post-peace economic, political, and social developments there. Zarif's comments were made during a meeting between the representatives of the Afghan government, the Taliban's political delegation, and a series of other high-ranking officials in Tehran. Iran has announced that it will soon produce uranium metal enriched to 20% purity. The country says a product will be used as fuel in the Tehran reactor. Earlier, we were joined by our Vienna correspondent, Homa Lezgi, who gave us the details.
The decision that's been announced now, and the IAEA was informed of this, according to Mr. Gharibabadi, Iran's ambassador, 9 days ago, is Iran is now going to produce uranium metal plates, or in the words of Mr. Gharibabadi, a silicide fuel plate, using enriched uranium, and uranium that's been enriched up to 20%. So this is the first time that this is going to happen in Iran. And in his own statement, Mr. Gharibabadi goes on to give a bit of clarification what this silicide fuel plate means. He says that silicide fuel is a modern kind of nuclear fuel, and you said there only a handful of countries have the technology to produce it. Iran, we know, the agency had said before this that it had already produced uranium metal, but not using enriched uranium. So Mr. Gharibabadi confirmed that Iran had been conducting research and development on this about 3 months ago, but now the new process involves using 20% enriched uranium to make this silicide fuel plate. And what is it used for? Tehran, of course, saying that it's for the research reactor in Tehran as fuel. And Mr. Gharibabadi also mentioned in his statement that this development is going to significantly improve the quality and quantity of radiopharmaceuticals.
Moving on, the United States and European powers have expressed concern over Iran's decision to make enriched uranium metal. The U.S. has called the move provocative and, quote, an unfortunate step backwards. State Department spokesman Ned Price says Iran's plan could affect efforts to revive the 2015 nuclear deal during talks in Vienna. Britain, France, and Germany have accused Iran of endangering the ongoing talks in the Austrian capital. Iran has already stressed its remedial steps are within the nuclear agreement. It also noted that they are in response to the U.S.'s withdrawal from the accord and imposition of sanctions in 2018, as well as Europe's failure to live up to its commitments under the deal. Political commentator Jason Unruh says the U.S. and European parties to the 2015 nuclear deal are not in a position to accuse Iran of endangering talks to revive the accord.
The United States and the rest of the parties have no business saying that Iran is somehow sabotaging the negotiations by doing what it is that they said that they were going to do. I mean, the straight-up fact remains the United States, particularly Biden, the U.S. president, said that once he took over, there would be a new JCPOA. They would return to the nuclear deal, and everything would be back to where it was before the election of Donald Trump. Unfortunately, Biden has done the opposite. He has not returned to it as he said he was going to. When Biden came back to office, he said he was going to remove those new sanctions and then return to the deal. Well, this is not what's happened. In fact, the United States has kept those sanctions on Iran and then demanded Iran make even more concessions on top of it. Frankly, this shows the two-faced nature of the United States. So I think that this is a complete lie by the United States. It's a complete lie by those inside of the actual agreement, because they're the ones sabotaging this day and night by not doing the very thing they said that they were going to do.
And as promised, we're going to go back to our top story where Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has said the people and the leaders of Afghanistan must make difficult decisions for the future of their country. The comments come as Tehran hosts a meeting between the representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban's political delegation. Professor Fuad Izadi is with us once again from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Professor Izadi, let's pick up where you left off, giving us details and your perspective about the conference, and also what decisions are ahead for the people of Afghanistan and for the government as well.
Well, as you know, Iran has about 900 kilometers of border with Afghanistan, and Iran is hosting about 2 million Afghanistani refugees inside Iran, and this has been going on for a long time. You know, a lot of people from Afghanistan came to Iran 40 years ago, 30 years ago. Instability in Afghanistan and fights have continued for many, many years. The hope that Iran has is that finally we may get to peace with U.S. Troops leaving Afghanistan, at least a good portion of the American troops leaving Afghanistan. Iran hopes to see peace. We are going to go through a period of instability. And Iran is worried about more bloodshed in Afghanistan. Having a peaceful Afghanistan is obviously good for Iran and other neighbors of Afghanistan. It's also good for people in Afghanistan. Achieving that goal of reaching a settlement in Afghanistan and achieving peace is not going to be easy. If it was easy, it would have been done a long time ago. Hosting the meeting today in Tehran between the different parties that are having difficulties in Afghanistan is a step by Iran to basically see if difficulties and problems can be resolved. It's the responsibility of Iran to do this, being a good neighbor to Afghanistan. And the hope is that once Afghanistan sees peace and stability, then Iran can help Afghanistan with its economic recovery and reconstruction. This is the hope that we have. And so finally, after many decades, the people of Afghanistan that are residing in Iran can go back to the country that that they belong to. And that's the hope, that reaching some level of stability is going to resolve the problems that we have seen in Afghanistan.
One quick question before we leave you, Professor Izadi. What did the foreign presence, U.S. and NATO foreign troops presence in Afghanistan achieve over the two decades that were there?
Nothing. They have achieved nothing. As you know, the Americans have spent about $2.2 billion. That's the estimate of Brown University in the United States. About 3,000 American soldiers have been killed in Afghanistan. Lots of people have been injured, and many, many more people in Afghanistan have been killed by Americans. The estimate of Brown University is 241,000 people have been killed in the last 20 years. So they have achieved nothing. They came on a wrong promise. If they had difficulties with bin Laden, they could arrest him, or they could deal with him in other ways. Instead, the U.S. government during the Bush administration decided to invade the country to prosecute a group Obviously, they had geopolitical ambitions by invading Afghanistan, and now they're leaving without any success. The result of many years of occupation of Afghanistan has been death and destruction, and so a lot of people are happy to see Americans leave, but we need to make sure that the new order that's going to result in Afghanistan is going to be a peaceful order and a peaceful transition to a system that is free from foreign occupation and in line with creating a country that's prosperous.
All right, thanks a lot. Professor Fouad Izadi joining us from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Elsewhere, the chief commander of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Iranian forces are fully prepared to face the plots of the enemies with vigilance. Major General Hossein Salami made the comment in a ceremony of the delivery of new equipment to the IRGC ground force. He said the Iranian nation is steadfast in protecting its independence and sovereignty. Salami hailed Iran's advanced homegrown military and intelligence capabilities. He reiterated the defensive nature of Iran's policy, saying the country has never sought offense. However, the IRGC chief stressed that Iran would respond to the enemy's offenses with strength and consistency. In an exclusive interview with Press TV, the president of the International Committee of the Red Cross has painted a dire picture of the humanitarian situation in Yemen due to the Saudi-led war and blockade.
Consequences on the impact of the present situation of the war, the violence, the injuries, the disruptions is enormous. 80% of the population today is dependent on humanitarian assistance. 50% of the health infrastructure is destroyed. Millions of Yemeni are in need, are displaced, and therefore have been uprooted from their communities. This is a very serious humanitarian crisis and one of the reasons why it is today the third largest operation of ICRC worldwide.
Moore said the restriction on Yemen's imports have significantly compounded the situation since the country is dependent on foreign trade and aid. He expressed frustration at the widening gap between needs and response because of war and displacement in Yemen. The ICRC chief said the war in the impoverished country has gone on far too long, and those affected need to return to income-generating activities. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war and imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Around a quarter of a million of Yemenis have died, including from some indirect causes, such as lack of food. Also, officials in Australian state of New South Wales extend a coronavirus lockdown in Sydney amid a rise in cases related to the Delta variant of the virus.
The New South Wales government, based on the health advice, which is our key indicator, made the difficult decision to announce the extension of the lockdown and the existing restrictions in the regions for 1 week further until Friday midnight, the 16th of July. Now, the reason for this is as...
The state prime minister said the reason for the extension of is that the Delta variant is a game changer as it's more transmissible. The decision comes after the state reported 27 new cases. Sydney has been under lockdown since June the 26th. After a Delta variant outbreak, the city's total infections have now topped 350. The more virulent strain has also caused an extension of social distancing measures in South Korea. The country reported more than 1,200 new cases in the past 24 hours, the highest daily caseload since late December. South Korea has so far registered more than 162,000 cases. Seoul correspondent Frank Smith says the slow pace of coronavirus vaccination in South Korea has upped the surge of the Delta variant infections, especially among the youth.
South Korea is, you know, struggling as well with the new Delta variant entering the country and accounting for a higher percentage of new cases. The government, again, is going to consider stricter measures. It's also going to conduct increased testing, especially young people, which have made up a very high percentage of new cases. We got to remember, South Korea is a little bit slower to roll out the vaccine than some other developed countries, with just 30% of the population receiving one dose and only 10% getting the sort of recommended two doses of vaccine so far.
Search and rescue teams have retrieved 8 more bodies from the ruins of a collapsed building in the U.S. state of Florida, raising the death toll to 36. Officials say 109 people have remained missing since the 12-story building partially collapsed on June 24th. Search operations are in progress amid interruptions caused by Tropical Storm Elsa. On Sunday, rescue work was halted for the controlled demolition of the remaining structure. The cause of the collapse is still unclear, but a 2018 report by a consultant engineer had warned about major structural damage to the condominium. New York has become the first U.S. state to declare a disaster emergency order to address rising gun violence.
And it is an emergency. And I want the people of the state to understand that. And I want them to respond to the emergency for the way it is. So today, first state in the nation is going to declare a disaster emergency on gun violence.
The governor added that the state saw 51 shootings over the 4th of July holiday weekend. The directive will funnel nearly $140 million toward gun violence intervention and prevention programs. Under the executive order, a special police unit to fight firearms trafficking into the state will also be created. The directive follows the Independence Day weekend, when at least 150 people were killed and more than 400 shootings across the country. That's a wrap for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Brazilian president has come under further pressure after being personally implicated in an alleged corruption racket involving the supposed misappropriation of his workforce's wages. Jair Bolsonaro, a far-right populist who admires Donald Trump, took office in January of 2019, vowing to forever free the fatherland from the yoke of corruption. Mr. Bolsonaro is suffering a wretched spell even by the turbulent standards of his own 2.5-year presidency. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian columnist Tom Phillips. The piece is titled, Corruption Allegations Increase Pressure on Bolsonaro. The Brazilian president has come under further pressure after being personally implicated in an alleged corruption racket involving the supposed misappropriation of his workforce's wages. Jair Bolsonaro, a far-right populist who admires Donald Trump, took office in January of 2019, vowing to forever free the fatherland from the yoke of corruption. Mr. Bolsonaro is suffering a wretched spell, even by the turbulent standards of his own two-and-a-half-year presidency. On Monday, 5th of July, however, a leading Brazilian news website published a series of reports that threatened to fatally undermine Bolsonaro's already tenuous claim to be a clean-living conservative. UOL claimed its reports, called The Secret Life of Jair, suggested he had presided over an embezzlement scheme known as the Rachadinha during his almost 30 years as a lawmaker in the lower house of Congress between 1991 and 2018. One UOL story featured audio recordings obtained from an unnamed source in which Andrea Sequeira Valle, the sister of Bolsonaro's second wife, allegedly discussed how her brother was sacked from his job in Bolsonaro's congressional chambers. André caused loads of problems because André never gave back the right amount of money that had to be given back, you see. He was supposed to give back 6,000 reals, but André would only hand over 2,000 or 3,000 reals. This went for ages until Jair said, "Enough, get rid of him, because he never gives me back the right amount of money." In Brazil, the illegal and reportedly widespread practice by which politicians demand a slice of their staff's wages is known as the Rachadinha, a slang term which roughly translates as salary split or cashback. Bolsonaro's senator son, Flavio Bolsonaro, has long been dogged by similar allegations that he oversaw such a scam during his time as a state congressman in Rio de Janeiro. In a second recording obtained by UOL, the woman identified as Jair Bolsonaro's former sister-in-law says, "It's not nothing I know. There's a lot that I could do to screw Jair's life. That's what they're afraid of." The revelations, which Bolsonaro's lawyer rejected as being based on untruthful and non-existent facts, sparked renewed calls for impeachment of a president who is already facing mounting public anger over his anti-scientific response to the COVID-19 pandemic, which has already killed nearly 525,000 Brazilians. Three mass anti-Bolsonaro demonstrations have been held since late May, most recently on Saturday, when thousands of dissidents hit the streets after allegations of dodgy dealings involving the procurement of COVID vaccines. "Bolsonaro's tenure in the presidency is becoming increasingly intolerable," tweeted Vempra Rua. Hit the Streets, a right-wing group that played a key role in the 2016 impeachment of the then-president, Dilma Rousseff. Leonardo Sakamoto, a UOL columnist, claimed the recordings provided strong evidence that Jair Bolsonaro had presided over a mafia scheme and the presidency had been captured by a crime conglomerate. Bolsonaro's lawyer, Frederick Wassef, told journalists no cashback scheme ever existed in the chambers of Congressman Jair Bolsonaro or any of his sons. "Bolsonaro is suffering a wretched spell even by the turbulent standards of his own two-and-a-half-year-old presidency, which critics say has inflicted historic damage on Brazil's environment, public health, and international reputation." In March, Bolsonaro's main political rival, The former president, Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva, roared back on the political scene with polls suggesting Lula would trounce Bolsonaro in next year's presidential election. In April, the Senate launched a parliamentary inquiry into Jair Bolsonaro's COVID response, with its televised hearings cementing in the minds of voters the president's responsibility for Brazil's chaotic and some are now saying corrupt handling of the health emergency. In late June, the inquiry heard explosive allegations that Jair Bolsonaro had failed to act after being alerted to suspicions over a 1.6 billion real deal to import India's Covaxin shot. Bolsonaro has denied any wrongdoing and last week tried to distance himself from the claims of health ministry corruption, declaring, "I've no way of knowing what goes on in the ministries." At last Saturday's protest, however, many demonstrators carried placards denouncing what they called the deadly human impact of alleged corruption within Jair Bolsonaro's administration. "Who did you lose because of a dollar?" said one poster, referring to separate allegations that a health ministry official sought $1 kickbacks for the purchase of AstraZeneca vaccines. Another protester's placards read, "Bolsonaro behind bars now." Mauricio Machado, a 43-year-old waiter who joined the rally, said, "He's corrupt. He's a denialist. I'm not a psychiatrist, but perhaps he's a psychopath." Despite growing calls for Jair Bolsonaro's impeachment, to which the right-wing New Party added its voice on Monday, experts say that remains an improbable outcome. Bolsonaro's ratings are plummeting, but he has brokered a sturdy, if capricious, support base in Congress, including the lower house president, Arthur Lira, who would need to approve any impeachment proceedings against the president. "Impeachment doesn't depend on the opposition. Impeachment depends on Arthur Lira," said Maria Cristina Fernandez, a columnist for the Valor Economico newspaper. Fernandez added, "And Arthur Lira has shown no sign of wanting to do anything."
The Spotlight.
Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister has appealed to the international community to save his country that he's warning is only a few days from a social explosion. The World Bank has called the crisis in the Arab country one of the worst depressions of modern history. National currency has lost most of its value, pushing more than half of the population into poverty. To make matters worse, politicians have not been able to agree on a new government since August 4th. When a huge explosion hit Beirut port. Now, what are the underlying reasons for the situation? Anything can be done about it?
An economic crisis came under the spotlight in Lebanon in October 2019 after the then government of Saad Hariri proposed plans to raise new taxes on tobacco, petrol, and voice calls via messaging services such as WhatsApp. The Hariri government sought to drum up more revenue amid a shortage of foreign currency. But the plans led to mass protests against economic turmoil and corruption. Eventually, the plans were called off and the government stepped down. But the financial situation continued to worsen amid the coronavirus pandemic. Hariri's successor, Hassan Diab, also resigned after a deadly explosion at the Beirut port in August 2020 that caused billions of dollars of damage. The Lebanese currency has so far lost more than 90% of its value, and more than half of the population has been sunk into poverty, as the country also faces severe fuel shortages. In the wake of the deepening economic crisis, Diab, who is a caretaker premier now, warned on Tuesday that Lebanon is only days away from what he called a social explosion. Diab, whose country has failed to form a new government in almost 11 months, also urged foreign donors to release financial aid to save the nation and do not link it to the government formation.
Linking aid to Lebanon with government formation has started to threaten the lives of people and to the Lebanese entity because the pressures that are being exercised and the siege imposed on Lebanon do not affect the corrupt. Instead, it is the Lebanese people who pay the heavy price that threatens their lives and their future.
On Monday, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah Resistance Movement blamed the United States for economic crises. Syed Hassan Nasrallah said Washington is wielding the threat of sanctions against the Lebanese government to prevent it from receiving aid from other countries. Talks over the formation of a new cabinet have stalled as President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri remain at loggerheads over the coming government's makeup and reform agenda. This comes as the U.S. and some of its Western and regional allies are at odds with Beirut over the role of Hezbollah in Lebanon's politics. The resistance movement and its allies now hold the majority of parliamentary seats following elections in 2018. Irrespective of the ongoing crisis in Lebanon, the country's main woes are rooted in the power-sharing system, which is a legacy of the French colonialism. Nonetheless, many are worried that the political vacuum and chaos in Lebanon could plunge the Mediterranean nation into a new civil war like the one it experienced for 15 years until 1990.
Now, welcome to the Spotlight. Joining me in tonight's show that has to do with the Lebanon situation will be Professor of the Lebanese International University, Jamal Wakim, in Beirut. And also journalist and political commentator, Said Mohsen Abbas, in London. Now, welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Let's go to Lebanon first. Professor Wakim, what's going on in Lebanon? You know, the country has been in crisis for more than a year. What are the root causes of the crisis in that country?
Well, there are several reasons, but mainly the main reason is American pressures on Lebanon, on Lebanese economy, in order to force the political elite to isolate Hezbollah as part of the U.S. plan to draw Lebanon under its influence, fully under its influence, at a time when it's planning to dissolute the Palestinian cause, force the neighboring countries of Palestine to neutralize the refugees, give them nationalities and settle them in their country, and prevent the Palestinian refugees from their right to return to their homeland, and at the same time marginalize Lebanon and make it like a dependent state, a state dependent on Israel, like a buffer zone for Israel. And that's why Hezbollah stands, and some of its allies stand, as an obstacle to these geopolitical plans of the United States, and that's why the United States is pressuring the country to go on the brink of collapse in order to implement its agenda, even if it's at the expense of its own proxies in the country. So that's why the political elite and the economic elite that have been dependent on the West for too long, since the 17th and 18th century, they cannot dare, they wouldn't dare, to choose to seek alternatives to Western tutelage over the country. That's why they refused all help coming from Russia, from Iran, and from China so far, because they know they were even threatened by the United States, that they know where their assets are hidden, financial assets, bank assets, and Western banks, and they can confiscate them. And here I'm talking about 80% of the political elite and the economic elite, including all of 14 of March coalition and part of March 8 coalition, by the way, even some allies of Hezbollah. Hezbollah. Too bad. We need to admit this.
Okay. Now, turning to London, Said Mohsen Abbas, the U.S. has also imposed a number of sanctions. Speaking of banks, Professor Wakim mentioned, it's not only banks, it's also individuals and Lebanese central banks. So how serious have the U.S. sanctions impacted the Lebanese economy?
Of course, it's very serious. In fact, Lebanon's GDP plummeted from close to U.S. $55 billion in 2018 to an estimated U.S. $33 billion in 2020. So you can see a major collapse there, while the GDP per capita fell by around 40% in dollar terms. All this is subject to extraordinarily high uncertainty. So the real GDP is this year projected to contract by a further 9.5%. Now, this is not an accident. This is engineered economic terrorism. And this is what the levers of power of the money mafias that run most of the global, if you like, control mechanisms are involved in. They do it time and time again. They've done it in Venezuela. They've been doing it to the Islamic Republic of Iran. If you look at Russia, even China is not, averse for them to lean on. So this is neoliberal imperialism, using economic terrorism to subjugate people. There are lots of different ways of subjugating people. It's not just a military boots on the ground effort. Of course, the Americans learned their lesson in Lebanon when they went scuttling out of Lebanon after one attack by the Lebanese resistance at that time back in the days post-Civil War. Nobody wants to go back to civil war in Lebanon, but when they've tasted what that was about for, near on a decade, if not more, where there was absolute murder and mayhem within the nation. Now, the most responsible force within all of this that I can see is the one that is being targeted primarily by these neoliberal, if you like, forces inside Lebanon, working for the external Zio-Western imperialist forces, and that is Hezbollah. People like Mustafa Alouch, former MP of Lebanon, are on record as openly regarding Hezbollah as the primary foe of Lebanon. Absolutely laughable, really, but these people exist in the Lebanese political circumstances, and yet the responsibility that Hezbollah has shown, in spite of its abilities militarily, in not interfering directly in any kind of belligerent way in Lebanese politics is pretty admirable. And I think what Hassan Nasrallah has said, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, has said this week is very, very important. You know, he alluded in his recent speech at a conference concerning the worsening economic crisis in Lebanon. He blamed the U.S., saying it's American policy that's the main reason for the crisis, and that the Americans want to besiege, punish, and prevent any aid that comes to Lebanon. This is exactly what's happening. He's admitted that there are incorrect government policies, those are part of the causes of the economic crisis. But of course, the people who've been running the show, the likes of Hariri, are essentially sellouts. They're in Saudi Arabian pockets, which are in the pockets of the Americans. So to be honest with you, Lebanon has got an internal political corruption issue, which is the primary problem, in my opinion. And of course, there are, as my colleague pointed out, there is a solution. First of all, resistance, economics, getting rid of these neoliberal IMF, World Bank threats and subjugation to them is the first thing that needs to happen, and a reliance more eastwards towards Iran, which is ready to supply oil and gas, and the likes of China and Russia and others. I think that's the direction, but only if these corrupt politicians can first be brought to book.
Okay. Now, Professor Wakim, it's also the EU. The EU is threatening Lebanon, and at the time the country is on the verge of collapse. And so what's the role of Europe, especially France, in the current crisis besetting Lebanon?
Well, France is dependent on the U.S., has been dependent on the U.S. for too long. First, since ousting General Charles de Gaulle in the late 1960s, by the first maybe colored revolution of the time, and of course after 2004, with the famous Normandy summit between Jacques Chirac and George W. Bush in June 2004. So France fully came under the American tutelage, and it's only implementing policies that go by the interests, the geopolitical interests of the United States, in the hope of getting a fraction of the spoils of war. So that's regarding France. Of course, Western Europe, the European Union, is under U.S. influence, and of course is integrated into the monetary system that is dominated by the United States. That's why they cannot but implement policies that go or that are, approved by the American agenda. So the Europeans, and mainly France, is an accessory of the United States in the region. The Macron, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, posed as the facilitator of implementing American strategy at one point, that he could do or he could succeed where others failed. So he had a green light by the Americans, but on the condition of isolating Hezbollah and bringing Lebanon under full American hegemony, which didn't occur, and this was the reason why the French initiative failed in the first time. So I believe that the Europeans don't have an independent role. They are mere accessories to the U.S. strategy. And even if it was at the expense of the European national security, because the Europeans would be one of the primary party affected by instability in Lebanon, with the influx of refugees from Lebanon, instability that could affect also neighboring countries, including nearby Cyprus, or even it would affect Greece with the refugee issue. So all this is disregarded by the European Union in order to please the United States and its geopolitical agenda in leading hostile policies against what it considers as its competitors at world hegemony, mainly Russia, Iran, and China.
Okay. So, Mohsen Abbas, in the middle of all of these issues, we have the problem of forming a new government, and Prime Minister Desni Sadhari has failed to form a cabinet. What's the catch? I mean, why aren't the Lebanese leaders unable to reach a consensus over forming a new government?
Well, because half of them, or, well, perhaps not half, but certainly a large number of them, have got their fingers in the corruption pie and are totally and utterly linked to external forces, largely Saudi and, of course, what I call Zio-Arabian connections. They're getting direct funding, and that's what maintains their sort of daily bread and butter, and they're not willing to let that go. They're also, of course, under the threat, as we mentioned earlier, from American access to their accounts, etc. So to be fair, I mean, these chaps, unless there is a what I call a night of the long knives, in a way purging of such corrupt politicians, the Lebanon situation will remain stagnant. I mean, they are the ones who are stagnating it absolutely deliberately. It's so hypocritical that they've not even been able to get to the bottom of what happened at the port. And they report the explosion that took place. Hezbollah and the Secretary General of Hezbollah have said time and time again that they want answers and want clarity about what went on. The report seems to be going on and on. But what we know is that these kinds of incidents are being engineered to make Lebanon come to its knees. Because the fundamental factor is that Lebanon is, or certainly Hezbollah, is the only force to have defeated Israel toe-to-toe, militarily, on the ground. And I think that everybody knows very clearly that it is Hezbollah that needs to be destabilized by Israel, and Israel is using the American economic leverage, sanctioning leverage and threats to try to essentially secure itself. I mean, it's a forlorn cause, because ultimately, Hezbollah have been able to exercise their newfound muscle in the places like Iraq and Syria, essentially being a major factor in rescuing the sovereignty of those nations mm-hmm. at a time when the ISIS, the Israeli-American unleashed attack dogs, ISIS, were about to overrun those nations. Essentially, they have been the primary force that went in and not only trained but fought and gave lives of the Lebanese resistance to prevent Lebanon itself collapsing, because we also saw these forces moving into Lebanon. So, in fact, Hezbollah is the one factor which keeps Lebanon, if you like, from being overrun as a vassal state of American and Israeli, if you like, imperialism. Yet you've got these people who would rather side with the likes of Benny Gantz. And in fact, I'd just like to say that he actually laughably offered humanitarian aid to Lebanon this week, saying, as an Israeli, as a Jew, and as a human being, my heart aches seeing the images of people going hungry on the streets of Lebanon. Right. I mean, it's almost so hilarious, you could laugh at it. This is an Israel which invaded Lebanon more than twice, has tried to annex Lebanon, is the first domino to fall in the Ginon plan, which they constantly push in the area. And yet here he is bleeding his heart out about how he's concerned about Lebanon. Well, you know, we know Lebanon's suffering from a worsening economic crisis because of these people, okay. Because of the violence and the protests and the false flag operations mm-hmm. and the psyops that they're carrying on constantly against this nation, violating its sovereignty in terms of the airspace. You know, their flights of the Israeli airplanes go over regularly to bomb the likes of Syria. You know, and of course, anything that happens, any protests that break out in this city, really, ultimately, are all at the at the foot of Israelis and the Americans who are causing this.
We're running fast out of time. Let me put this question to Professor Wakim. You know, there is a plethora of problems the country facing. National currency has lost 90% of its value. Fuel prices have risen by 50%. Food prices have tripled. Pharmaceuticals are hoarded. Majority of people have only 2 hours of electricity. Who's to blame for this?
Well, of course, we have to blame the corrupt political and economic elite that is tightening its grip on the country with the support of the West mainly. 90% of the political elite in Lebanon is directly or indirectly linked to the West and takes its instructions from the West, except for Hezbollah and tiny groups in Lebanon. So, of course, corruption. The backward political system that is running the country, that has been running the country for the past two centuries, I mean confessionalism, but also the mercantile elite that is imposing its full control of the economy through the banks, the financial system, which amounts to 90% of the Lebanese economy. And this sector is fully in the hands of the Americans. And when they wanted to switch off the light on the country, they did it with few sanctions that led to the banking system to collapse its knees, and with it the whole Lebanese economy that depends on the banking system alone.
Okay.
So that's why this is what happened, and I believe that we don't have an alternative too bad with an alternative lead to build mm-hmm. an alternative model, and in order to confront the American attempt at imposing their geopolitical agenda on the country and in the region.
Okay. Now, on that note, we'll come to the end of this show, Spotlight Show. So let me thank our guest, Red Professor of the Lebanese International University, Jamal Wakim in Beirut, and journalist and political commentator, Saif Mohsen Abbas, in London, with their contribution. And that's it for this edition of the Spotlight. I've been your host, Behrouz Najib. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام لا فضيلة كالجهاد ولا جهاد كمجاهدة الهوى.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "There is no greater distinction than jihad, and no jihad like combating one's self."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, in the beautiful conversations of the infallible Imams, we find that Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam, and this Imam whom spread so much knowledge and wisdom across the Muslim world, we find that this divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, he talks about these qualities and these ethics and these characteristics which are divine and spiritual characteristics. And so in his conversations with his companions, his friends, his relatives, and even the average person, we find that he emphasizes these characteristics in his conversations. Now you would ask, well, why is it so important to emphasize these kind of qualities and characteristics and these Islamic etiquettes, if you will? Well, dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners, dear friends, when we inculcate these divine and spiritual qualities and characteristics and traits within us, these divine qualities, when they are implemented across the board, we will see that we will begin to move towards a perfect society, a utopian society, a happy society, a prosperous society, a society which is based upon love and justice, friendship and brotherhood. So Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, in this conversation, he talks about certain qualities which he says are bad qualities, and that he prevented the Muslims from having these qualities. And so Imam al-Baqir says that there are certain qualities which the person will witness the evil results of that bad quality even before they die. One of these qualities, dear friends, is oppression. Dhulm, as it is said in Arabic. Oppression. Oppression, dear brothers and sisters, Imam al-Baqir says in this conversation with his companion, oppression leads to evil results for the one who is committing oppression. Now, oppression comes in a whole wide variety of manifestations and faces. Oppression is not just, you know, getting up and killing an innocent person. Yes, that is oppression, but oppression also includes lying, backbiting, cheating, being untrustworthy, not fulfilling a trust, an amana, right? This is oppression. This is oppression on others. For example, being mean, hurting others' feelings, being rude, right? Spiritually and physically harming others. This is oppression. But there's also oppression against the self, committing sins, not asking for forgiveness, disobeying Allah. These are all forms of oppression. And of course, there is global oppression, global powers oppressing weaker powers. So, dear friends, be very careful, as Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam says in this dialogue, that oppression is one of those evil traits where the one who commits oppression will witness the evil results for themselves of this oppression even before they die. This is dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. Try to be understanding of the source you're getting the hadith from. If it's an unknown source, then there's a bigger question mark on it. If a random social media post says Amir al-Mu'mineen said this, then there's a bigger question mark on that. If he said it, sam'an wa ta'ata, we accept it, it's heard, it's we submit to it, and so on and so forth. But did he say it? There's no reference there, there's a big question mark. I can't accept this. If some speaker said this,